Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. After 15 episodes spanning three continents and thousands of years, Season 2 of Wartime has come to a close. On this ancient world wrap-up, we discuss the highs and lows of the series, the theme of Season 3, and for the first time, answer your questions on the air. You have written from all corners of the globe, and the conversation is stronger than ever. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the lasting legacy they leave behind that helps shape our modern age. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer, on my author's website, bradykreitzer.com, and your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. Today we wrap up Season 2 of our podcast. We look to the future, and for the first time, we answer your questions. And we've got some great ones, and I'm very excited about sharing them with you. Overall, I would say, we broke some new ground on Season 2. For the most part, I think, when we think about the ancient world, all too often, we have a very narrow view of it. We view it as irrelevant, or we view it as past its time. It's quite literally past its expiration date. But I think one of the things we've really got to here in Season 2 is that the events of the past produce clear and meaningful results in our own world. We talked in great detail about the great river valleys of the ancient time, and about how that culture eventually crept into Europe, which really led to the birth of a Western civilization. Now, to be sure, there's much, much more we could have covered. And we'll talk about some of the reasons that we didn't, but for the most part, I'm very happy with the detail and the time we could spend on what we did. Now, I've heard from many of you, and I've received many questions dealing with the Roman Empire. If you'll notice, we sort of stopped pretty succinctly at the end of the Greco-Persian Wars. And the reason I stopped there, very simply, was a matter of time. We could have gone into ancient Rome, but I didn't want to do that in two or three or four or even five episodes. Ancient Rome really deserves its own season. It's very much its own subfield of history. You know, one of the things as historians, and I get this question a lot, that we do, is not necessarily about finding new material. It's not necessarily about unearthing some ancient tomb that hasn't seen the light of day for generations. But really, it's about looking at sources, looking at endless, infinite volumes of source material, and making the decision what to leave in and what to remove. Because you have to understand, as a historian, you can't cover everything. People have tried, and that's a guaranteed way to fail. Instead, you have to use your historical training, you have to rely on your instincts, you have to, and I don't think enough historians do this, think like a reader, ask yourself, what would I like to read? And you have to only cover the pertinent material, or the material most important to making your primary argument. I've written now 4 books in the field of imperial history. This has been my greatest weapon, the ability to discern what's essential and what is not. So I think that's, again, for those of you who are waiting for the Roman Empire episodes, hopefully a good enough explanation. It's certainly the reasoning that I used as we went through Season 2. But it's always a very interesting exercise to review a lot of this, and I'll admit, I've learned a lot in this season as well, and I'm not ashamed to admit that. I'll share very honestly with you, one of the things I always tell my students is that the best way to learn something is to teach, because there's an obligation to yourself to be true to the material, to review the material, and really be on point with a lot of your arguments, so I've really enjoyed the season thus far. For those of you that have been following along on the podcast feed, you'll notice that we haven't had a live show for about 3 weeks. And the reason that I've done that was because I wanted to allow listeners who listen every Friday, as many of you do, and those who find the podcast later, to gather their thoughts and send in their materials in preparation for the very first question and answer episode in the history of the Wartime Podcast. Now, for those of you not familiar with our previous episode, here's how it works. If you ask me a question or you submit a comment that we use on the air, I will send you a copy of any one of my books. And those of you whose messages I'm about to read have already been contacted with your relevant information, and your copies are in the mail, I assure you. But this has really turned out to be a very, very compelling little exercise, because I received information and questions and comments and, rightly so, complaints, which we'll leave off the air, literally from around the world. So I'm going to do my best to select the questions and comments on a global scale and not playing favorites, so to speak, with any one country. We've never done this before, and we certainly, because of the success that we've had with it, we'll be doing it again in the future. So if you have your questions, if you have your comments, get them ready. We'll be doing it a lot more in Season 3. And that's going to take us to our first question. This question comes from Charles W. in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Charles writes, "Brady, I'm a big fan of the show. What does the future hold? Is there going to be a Season 3 of Wartime? And have you decided on a topic yet?" Well, I'm very happy to say I have. Season 3 of Wartime, which I'll be recording in July and August, will feature an in-depth discussion of the American Revolutionary Era. The American Revolutionary Era. And there's a reason for that. Number one, it's my primary field of study. But number two, I really think the public needs a very grown-up discussion of the Revolutionary Era. A lot of what we get today, that is, again, admittedly a very popular field, is kind of a wishy-washy history. A lot of people don't have a real sense of the political implications of the American Revolution, the causes of the American Revolution, and the effects of the American Revolution. So, premiering this September, Season 3 of Wartime will be coming back in full swing with the American Revolutionary period. And I'm really excited to do it. So, thank you for that. For his efforts, Charles will be receiving a copy of my latest book, Gaius Suta and the Fall of Indian America. He'll be getting that in the mail anytime now. So, thank you very much. Okay, next question. This one comes from Johnny, from a little town, in his words, called Hemel Hempstead, outside of London, England. This one comes from across the pond, so we'll pay special attention to this one, given the announcement I just made about Season 3. He said, "Hi, Brady, I just found your podcast a couple of weeks ago, and I'm loving the format. Keep up the good work. I do have a couple of questions for you, and I was wondering if you could help me answer them. Number one, I found the Mycenaean episode especially interesting. Could you recommend me further reading on the topic? Number two, more interestingly, I think, I'm fascinated in the rise and fall of ancient powers and population levels. It seems that, reasonably often, peoples could experience great rises or falls, an example of the various Assyrian empires, in a relatively short time. Did these tend to accompany a rise or fall in population? And if so, where did the extra population come and go? Again, keep up the good work, and I look forward to hearing from you." Again, that's from Johnny from Hemel Hempstead, outside of London, England. Now, I responded to Johnny in an email about this, and we had a fairly lengthy conversation about it, but he brings up a really good point. In the next season of Wartime, the American Revolution, for example, I think the latest statistics have shown that something like 5 books per month are written every month on the American Revolution. But if you're interested in, say, the other 99.9% of history, where do you go to find a decent book on the topic? Well, the ancient world, I really believe, suffers greatly in that regard. And there's a few reasons for it. One of the most practical reasons, I think, is that many, many times, the ancient world is, I suppose you can say, conceded to the realm of archaeology. And rightfully so. Archaeologists are the ones discovering the new sources that change the way we view the ancient world every day. But many, many traditional historians have largely strayed away from it for that reason. And because of that, you very rarely see a book on the ancient world published in the modern sense. Part of it is because there's less of an appetite for it for the American and Western audience. And the other part is, again, it's generally conceded to the archaeologist, and they certainly deserve it. So the recommendation I made for John, and I'm not being paid for this, I swear, is a new book that's come out just this year by a historian named Eric Klein. And that book is called 1177 BC, The Year Civilization Collapsed. It's published by Princeton University Press as part of their Turning Points in Ancient History series, and it's doing quite well. It's about 264 pages, precisely, as a matter of fact. I found the book very interesting. Eric Klein is doing something that many historians aren't doing today, and it's looking at ancient sources and reevaluating them from a 21st century perspective. He's looking at major events we often view as separate, and looking at the larger, I suppose you can say, results of those catastrophes, whether they be disease or natural disaster, or so on and so forth. And he looks across what we would consider to be, here in Season 2, our entire range of discussion. So if you're interested in a really good new book by a historian on the ancient world, look at 1177 BC by Eric Klein. I think it's very well done. If you're looking for other books, however, in many cases you're relegated to textbooks because there just aren't that many available. But that's not the only solution. And I think there is one that, as a historian, I'm really not supposed to say, but I found very useful. One of the things I love about studying the ancient world is that, in many ways, you kind of have to see it with your own eyes. Reading it is important. But if the sources we have left behind are the actual artifacts themselves, a visual component, a visual understanding is absolutely essential. And one of the great things you can do for this is, of course, YouTube, a Google video search. You'd be amazed at the amount of good historical documentaries, and I mean well done historical documentaries, not, you know, 300 or something like that, that really take you to these places that show you these palaces and these remnants in a very real way. So never discount the internet. The internet is actually used for very important and very meaningful things aside from videos of cats and the usual dribble that you can see there. So that's what I would recommend. 1177 is a good book, but don't be afraid to watch a documentary because a lot of people spend a long time with them and they're really well done. Regarding Johnny's second question regarding populations rising and falling, where do they go, using the Assyrians as a good example, that's one of the real tricks and problems of ancient history, and again, why many historians, that is, purely historians, stay away from studying it. It's that the sources we have are incredibly limited. And as a historian, if you're not immersed in source material, that is, material from the time period, primary source material, it's very difficult to analyze, and you're very hesitant to speculate too much. Healthy speculation is good. Informed speculation is essential. But you never want to overstep your bounds. You never want to be too bold. Hubris is not a great quality for a historian. And as far as studying demographics, that's what we call that, demographic history, it's very difficult. Because very few ancient sources carved into stone, for example, or latent remaining sources from the time period really go into great deals of population numbers. Some of that's because they didn't consider population the way that we did before. Some of that is because they didn't consider everyone on an equal plane worth counting. Some of that's because we just don't have the material. Even if they did, we've lost it. Demographic history is a very worthwhile pursuit, but in the ancient context, it's very difficult to deal with. So, very good. That's Johnny from just outside of London. He'll be getting a copy of my first book, Major Washington's Pittsburgh and the Mission to Fort Lebeuf. Thank you for writing in, Johnny. I look forward to hearing from you again. Our next question, and it's a little more self-indulgent, comes from Bill in Pensacola, Florida. Bill asks, Brady, I've read all of your books. I found them very interesting. I am actually a transplant from the Northeast, So that's very interesting to hear from Bill, clearly moving to warmer climates in Florida. He asks, what's your next book based on? Are you writing a fourth book? And do you have any idea when it will be released? Thank you so much. I look forward to hearing from your future series. That's Bill. Well, Bill, as a matter of fact, I do have a fourth book coming out, and I've just finished writing it, and the contract is signed, so I think I can talk about it in some detail. My fourth book will be in the American colonial period once again. Again, I don't really believe in writing outside of your field. And it will study an aspect of the Revolution. And again, you're dealing with five books a month, typically, on the American Revolution that has gone almost unexplored for the better part of 100 years. And even when it was 100 years ago written about, it wasn't very flattering. It wasn't very successful or effective in any way. My next book will be on the Hessian soldiers who fought in the American Revolution. And more appropriately to say, the German soldiers who were paid by the British Empire to fight in the American Revolution. It was a very compelling study. Again, I finished writing it about a month ago, and it should be due for publication. And this is a very fluid date, sometime next summer or next fall. But I had a great experience writing it. I did get to apply some of my German that I knew to look at some of these sources. And I got to tell a very wonderful story that I think is going to shed a lot of new light on the time period in a way most people haven't considered. So you can expect my next book, Hessians, sometime in 2015. Excellent. Okay, moving forward. We have an email coming all the way from China. This is from York Lee in Tianjin City, China. York Lee says this, "Hello, I am Chinese. I live in China and am a college student. I have listened to your podcast for a couple of months since the beginning of season 2. Actually, I began listening to practice my English listening at first. However, I do really like your program now, and I do have a question. I thought maybe you should involve some parts of East Asia or South Asia, India or China, in the podcast. So I'd like to know, is it possible you'll talk about Asian history in the next episode or season? If so, I'd very much appreciate it. Thank you, and I'm waiting for your reply." York Lee, great question. Great question. Again, all the way from the People's Republic of China. I can be very frank with you. I have nothing against doing a season on any sort of Asian history. But I will say this. It would be a very specific history. The word Asian history is something that we see throughout the academic world. There's always one quote-unquote Asian historian, that is someone who studies the history of Asia. But if you look at the history of Asia for more than, say, 5 seconds, you begin to realize it's the single largest continent on the planet. It has numerous empires and numerous kingdoms operating sometimes together, sometimes separately, and literally billions of people within it. So Asian history, I think, is a horribly generic term. That being said, I found the history of China during the 19th century and the 18th century, the history of Japan during the Sengoku period at the same time period, the history of India in any number of ways to be very fascinating. And as an imperial historian, I've looked at all of them. Again, season 3 will be on the American Revolutionary period, York Lee, but I'm not going to write out an Asian history discussion anytime soon. I plan on doing this for quite a while, and judging by the response I've gotten, there would be an adequate, I think, audience for it. So we'll let you know in the future when that's going to be. Otherwise, York Lee has requested a copy of my book, Major Washington's Pittsburgh and the Mission to Fort Lebeuf, my first book, and he'll be getting that all the way from the other side of the world, here from the USA. So thanks for writing in. Thanks for writing in. I look forward to hearing from you in the future. This is a really interesting question I've got, and I was really hoping that someone would send it at the risk of just delivering some soliloquy as a result. But this comes from John, who does not say where he's from, but he sends this question. "I have always loved to read and study history. After a brief high school teaching career in the field, my biggest question is this. What is the best way to make a succinct and effective case for the importance of studying history? I have never been brief or succinct on this topic, and I'm sure you won't be either." John, you are a man after my own heart. We are kindred spirits. And that's a question that I think all of us, whether you're going into the field of history as a professional, or whether you just like history, or whether you're taking a history class, really has to ask yourself. You really have to look into that. Because in this day and age, it's going to be a very important question. Something very interesting happened to me in the previous semester. A student came up to me after the final, and he said to me, you know, I really like this class. When I signed up for it, I thought it would be horrible. And after I got through it, it wasn't that bad. Now, I think that's about as good a compliment as you can ask in the field of higher education, but I've been riding that baby for about 6 months now. So I'm gonna continue to build off that momentum. Not that bad. At any rate, it's a very interesting point. Why do we study history? And there's a very textbook answer. There's a very sort of polished professional answer. And that's the answer normally I would give. But I think, and I've been sort of telling this to whoever I could in the meantime, I'm going to be a little more practical with it. And I'm going to be a little bit controversial with it. But I think it has to be said. One of the things that drives me crazy about the academic field of history is that it has become a very exclusive club. Many of the people in the field of history that I meet, whenever you are either asking to work with them or asking what they're working on, have a very guarded opinion of the field. They're very hesitant to engage with a lot of new people. And I think that comes from, very honestly, the highest levels of the field. I think there's a very real problem with inclusiveness or a lack of inclusiveness in the academic world of history, in the discipline of history as a whole. And here's a good example. The reason I did this podcast is because I truly believe that in colleges and universities and museums all around the world, people are making incredible new discoveries in the field of history, discoveries that fundamentally change how we view the past. But their material almost never enters the public sphere in a practical way, in an effective way, in any way, in some cases. I know a person who recently published an article in an academic journal that, in his opinion, fundamentally changed the way we viewed a specific event. He published it. It was well received, but the issue is, it was only received by people in his field, people who have access to those journals. And that's the way it's always been done. But because there's been such a impetus on publishing in the academic sphere, whether it be an academic press or an academic journal, there's been a real push for peer review. That's the real benefit of doing this for those of you not in the field. One of the biggest casualties I found is that the average person doesn't have access to these journals. Quite frankly, I can't access them much of the time because I don't have the right codes to go into the libraries and do it. So here's the problem that I have. History today at the academic level, where the real positive change is taking place, the great reinterpretations and discoveries is taking place, has become exclusive to the point of almost futility. If you publish something in a journal, if you publish something from an academic press, it will reach a very select audience of people. It will reach people who have already made up their minds that history is a very important field. But all too often, it doesn't reach the people it really has to. And the people it really needs to reach are the people in the public sphere. People who aren't academics, but love history. People who aren't in the professional historical world or the professional museum world, but who are interested in keeping up on important trends. And because of that, many people have viewed history as superfluous or unimportant or as a luxury field in some way and not as an essential field. It's because history has willingly transformed its great ivory tower into its Tower of London, into its prison, if you would, keeping itself away from the people that need to receive it. We live in an age of a tough economy. We know that. We live in an age, especially in the United States, of austerity. That is, many universities are funded and schools by local state governments. And because they're funded by local state governments, they receive their money for things like historical research and even historical positions, jobs for historians. at a time when there's not a lot of money to go around. You really need to make a case, if you're a historian, you really need to make a case that your job and your field is still relevant, is still important. And all too often, because exclusivity has handcuffed the field, lay people who aren't in the field, who don't study it, don't see a reason to keep it around. And we've seen that a great deal in the United States, especially. History has never been less funded in the last 100 years than it is right now. So it's for that reason that I began doing this podcast, because I know from everyone who listens, there's a lot of very intelligent, very capable, very honest people who are desperate to have this knowledge, but who have no idea about the major advances we've made in the field. Many people who listen to this podcast, especially this season in the ancient world, will send me the email, and it's the same one over and over again, and I love getting it, telling me, Brady, I never knew this. I knew that the Egyptian world existed. I knew that Tutankhamun existed, but I never knew this new information. And the reason is, it's there, okay, but it's locked away in research libraries, and that's fine. There's a place for that. But in this day and age, I think you really have to show why you belong. You have to show why you're relevant, whether that's fair or not, because with the money comes the opportunity, especially in education. So why teach history, John? That's what I would say. Why is it relevant? It's who we are. It's where we're going. But I think more importantly, it's a fundamental exercise in thought. History doesn't have the most practical application, not something like electrical engineering, for example, and there's nothing wrong with that. But it's not exactly nursing, right? It's not exactly medical school. It's not exactly a field that's going to directly change someone's life. But if you don't have time for history, then it says, I think, something about your society, that you don't have time for thought for the sake of thought, or thinking for the love of thinking. It's not there. So I think that's a very important question you asked, John. And I look forward to hearing from you again and hearing your response. But I think that's really the case. Historians have in many ways put themselves in some of the positions, not totally, but some of the positions we find ourselves in. Again, we try so hard to impress our colleagues that we forget about the rest of the world. Don't forget, your colleagues are like 0.0001 of the people on the planet. There's a lot of people who deserve this history. There's a lot of people who want this history. Why in the world would we limit ourselves with all of this great material and all these great discoveries we've made by simply keeping them for ourselves? History is meant to be shared. I say it in every episode, and I'm going to say it in every episode. History is best when it's shared, because we forget that so often, and as a result, you see sort of the circumstances and consequences that we have now. One of the really great new fields that I'm not a part of, but hopefully I'm becoming a part of, is something called public history. Now, public history began as sort of like a branch off of museum studies, but really, in essence, what public history is making the history we love so much, the history that we make our careers out of, available to all the people, not for us to show off as experts, but to, again, engage in the discussion. History is one big conversation. Now, I don't know if that answered John's original question, why should we teach history? But I think it's an important notion that we have to set aside regardless, because there's a lot to it. And again, it says a lot about us if we choose to ignore this material. So very good, John. Thank you very much for the email. I look forward to hearing your response and hearing from you in the future. For our next question, it's a two-parter. It's going to come from Twitter, and it's going to come from Chris from Alabama. Chris will ask this on Twitter. At Brady Kreitzer. Here's a question for the podcast. What do you think about war as a force for good? What do you think about war as a force for good? And his second question, was the fate of Native American culture inevitable given the introduction of disease and warrior culture in empire? Two really great questions, Chris. And I'm really glad to have the chance to answer this. Kind of big for this podcast, but I think it's important. Number one, Can war be used as a force for good? That's going to depend on the historian you're talking to. Again, history is not about names and dates and places. It's not about knowing all the facts and being a walking encyclopedia. If you have that ability, you'll be really great at playing, you know, like Trivial Pursuit with your uncle over the holidays. But what historians do is take those facts and build an educated opinion, an educated argument. Anyone's argument is fine, but the question is, whose argument do you want to believe? Now, if you asked me about war being a force for good, what I would typically say is not very often. The Prussian philosopher Karl von Clausewitz said very famously in his treatise on war, and it's very funny because it's actually a very small part of his voluminous work. He said, "War is merely politics by another means." War is merely politics by another means. And I can't get that phrase out of my mind because I absolutely believe it. I think soldiers do good things. I think individuals fight for the right reasons. But individuals don't often start wars. Policymakers, ideologies start wars. Politics start wars. And politics, by their very nature, we can say, are troublesome entities, as we've seen over the last few years, and really over the last 5,000 years in many ways. But when you think about war, you know, one of the other quotes that always comes to my mind dealt with the American Civil War. This was from a historian talking about it. He said very famously, and I think this should resonate with you, that the Civil War was a rich man's war, but a poor man's fight. And for me, when I look at any war in world history, wars are not driven by the soldiers. They're certainly won by the soldiers, but they're motivated and they're put into motion by politics that are far beyond the reach of anyone actually holding a gun. War has accomplished many good things. We can say the Allies in World War II certainly stopped Adolf Hitler's Nazi regime. That was a good thing. But typically war as an entity, as an existing force, can have good results, depending on the side you're on, but often is began, I think, for very unsavory reasons. Now, you could be attacked and respond. There's a lot of things about that, I understand. But on the whole, if you ask me, I have yet to really find a war in the history of the world that didn't have a very disturbing and very similar trend of politics built into it. That, Chris, would be my answer to that question. So that was a good one. Number two, secondly, was the fate of Native American culture inevitable given the introduction of disease and warrior culture amongst empire? This is a question that's very near and dear to my heart. I am an imperial historian. I study British, French, and Native Empire in North America in the 18th century. That's my particular field. It's where I do my professional work. We have to be very careful to avoid a word like inevitable when we talk about history, because really nothing is inevitable. The universe always has what we'll call contingencies involved. Men make decisions. You can choose to fight or choose not to fight. You can choose a diplomatic route before going to war. Politics are always at play. Nothing is necessarily inevitable. But I will say that when Europeans began to conquer the Americas, what you've mentioned, disease, facilitated, we can say, the conquest in a much greater way. Think about this. Some estimates say, from the time the very first Europeans landed to about a decade later, something like as many as 95% of North America's peoples were dead. The vast majority of them never even saw the people that were killing them. They were killed by communicable disease, diseases that Europeans had antibodies to, natural immunities to, and people in the native world didn't. It really did facilitate the conquest in a great way, because it literally erased a population from a continent in many ways. So inevitable was not the word there, but it certainly did make it much easier. Certainly didn't make it much easier. So that's Chris from Alabama. Chris on Twitter. Thank you for the question. A lot of you got questions in. Again, we're trying to spread it around geographically a little bit. And this will take us, speaking of spreading it around geographically, to Arizona. This one comes from Carl from Arizona. Carl says, Brady, how do you feel about political figures writing history books? Why do you think they choose history books? And is there a place for them in the larger discussion of the field? I enjoyed the podcast. I look forward to hearing your answer. That one's from Carl in Arizona. Carl, you're going to get me into a little trouble with a question like that, but I am going to answer it. One of the, I think we can say, opportunity costs of the exclusive nature of history I've been talking about, that is, publishing in journals, publishing in university presses, and again, there's nothing wrong with it, but you are really only talking to a very small audience most of the time, is that you are giving up very important ground in the field. So what do we mean by that? I can tell you from what I do. I do book signings and lectures and live events all the time. I travel all the time. Go to BradyKreitzer.com. You'll see my schedule. Come out and say hello. I'll give you a free book. Mention wartime. But one of the things that I see is that people can't get enough of history. They love it. They have an unquenchable thirst for information. I'm blown away by it every time. But the issue is, as we focus all of our attentions in the academic world in just communicating with each other, what we're basically doing is, some say, preaching to the choir, maybe shouting at ourselves in a mirror. What we're really doing is giving up very valuable ground. And we're letting a lot of people who probably aren't qualified to write a history book, and quite frankly are probably writing it for the wrong reasons, to fill the void that we're leaving. Go to the Amazon top 10 lists on history, and you will see the overwhelming majority of those books are not written by classically trained historians. In fact, they're not even written by people who really love history. They're written by people who really love making money and people who think history is the vessel to do it. They might have political ambitions. They might be arguing a political ideology. But whatever they're doing, I really wish they wouldn't do it in the field of history. Maybe, you know, quantum physics will be their new thing. Maybe they can do literature. I don't know. But unfortunately, they often gravitate to history because we are so interested. And for many people, they get, I guess you can say, suckered into believing that the history they're receiving there is the real perception of history. Again, I'm not going to name names, and I'm certainly not going to take sides in any political debate. I have no interest in doing that. The smell does often come from both sides, left and right. But go to the top 10 list, and you'll see exactly what I mean. By only talking to ourselves, we've really given up that ground or left a void to be filled. And as expected, the wrong people are filling it. Now, the Wartime podcast will continue. And Brady Kreitzer's books, all found at BradyKreitzer.com, will continue. But the fight can't go on forever. I can't fight the tidal wave by myself. So if you are a person going into history, all too often we can kind of fall, I think, into the hypnotic sort of glow of the academic world. And that's fine. That's great. But don't forget, there's a much bigger world out there. History is meant to be shared. I'll say it 1,000 times more throughout the history of this podcast, but I'll continue to do it. We've got to share it. We've got to give the great material that we all discover every day and put it into the public sphere of conversation. Now, part of Carl's other question was this. Do they have any value? That is, these history books of somewhat questionable nature written by political figures. And I will say this till the day that I die. Yes, they do. I don't care who writes it. Anyone who writes a history book, whether they teach at Yale, Harvard, or Oxford, or whether they're just, you know, a senator from somewhere or maybe a talk radio host from somewhere else, anyone who writes a history book has the right to do it. That's part of who we are as Americans, but even more than that, if you're an American or not, it's part of what the historic discipline is. History is a conversation. It always has been. You can put anything into that conversation that you want. That's what this podcast is. It's an injection into a conversation. Everybody has an opinion. Everybody has an interpretation. They're all equally valid. The question is for you, the reader, which one do you ascribe to? You can take anyone's word for it that you want, and many people do on a large scale, but you have to ask yourself, what is this person's qualifications? Are they in a position to really explain this to me? What are you willing to buy? Again, all of these books are relevant. All of these books should be in the conversation. It's on you, the reader, to drown out the white noise and put your faith in what you believe in. I'm not going to say that's one book or the other, but it's an important one nevertheless. Okay, well, Carl will be getting a copy of Fort Pitt, A Frontier History, all the way to Arizona. Arizona, a number of very wonderful forts in its own right. And that's going to put a pin in our question and answer show for season two of Wartime. The Ancient World is done for now. I have a feeling we'll be back. It's been pretty popular. So the next time you're going to hear from me, if you don't come to a public event, and again, they're all listed at BradyKreitzer.com, is going to be in the fall, in September. Again, we'll be talking about the causes, the battles, and the effects of the American Revolution, really as grown-ups should. I've had a wonderful time this season. I really apologize to those of you who I haven't read on the air regarding your question and comments. I'll try and respond to all of you, but please keep them coming. Please keep your support there. Keep this history alive. Keep the conversation going. Remember, it's all valid. History is best when it's shared. Have a good summer. We'll see you in the fall. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.